You're listening to Labor News Radio, and my name is Glenn Lang. Labor News Radio is heard on over 20 radio stations around the world, as well as on Labor Start Radio on the Internet. It's distributed via the AINPOS Radio Project at radioforall.net and the Indie Media Project at radio.indymedia.org. It's also heard on KITR LP 101.5 in Kettle Falls, Washington. I want to thank everybody for listening, and thanks for your support.
To protect them from the view of the people wearing dirty rags and begging for their food, while they're serving up a banquet for the membership inside. The poor man on the bottom's contemplating suicide, 'cause he feels worthless. His hunger pains beyond belief.
That was The Return of Coxey's Army by Eddie Starr, Steelworker. Thanks, Eddie, wherever you are. Today we're going to talk about Jacob Coxey and the industrial army that he formed to march on Washington and protest the economic conditions that workers in this country were subjected to in the panic, the depression of 1893-94. the Reader's Companion to American History, says, following the Panic of 1893, the United States was plunged into a severe economic depression. In response to growing economic distress and mass unemployment in the winter of 1893-94, Jacob Seckler Coxey, a populist leader in Massillon, Ohio, and I hope I pronounced that right, proposed a recovery program. Congress should enact a large increase in the amount of legal tender currency in circulation, he argued. The extra money could be spent on public works, thereby providing jobs for the unemployed. Sometimes people express amazement that FDR had a plan ready to go when he was elected to the presidency in 1932. And, in fact, they enacted that plan so fast in the first 100 days that became the standard for success for a president. If you didn't get your programs enacted in the first 100 days, you were probably a lame duck president. But this is where he got a lot of his ideas. These economic cycles, these huge depressions had been going on and on, cycle after cycle, 1823, 1856, 1873 and 4, and 1893, and then 1929. So it was old news to people in those days, and people who had studied the issue knew what needed to be done in order to fix it, and that's why Roosevelt was able to put together a program that actually worked and prevented the at least the next two depressions that were going to come along if nothing had been done. But going back to 1893 and 94, Jacob Coxey had this program, and he wanted the government to print money and to hire people to do public works. And in order to bring his plan to the attention of Congress, he enlisted the support of Carl Brown in California and decided to send Washington a, quote, living petition. I'm quoting now again from the Reader's Companion to American History. A quote, living petition. A vast army of the unemployed masses. Coxey and Brown formed an organization called the Commonweal of Christ and left Massillon on Easter Sunday, March 25th, 1894, leading an army of 100 followers. They hoped to attract a further 100,000 en route and to arrive at the Capitol for a massive demonstration on May Day. Remember now, May Day in those days was Labor Day, and around the world it still is Labor Day. The first Monday in September is the corporate Labor Day, established so that American workers wouldn't have any sense of solidarity with other workers around the world. As an interesting aside to Coxey's program of having the government print more money so that they could hire people for public works, he had a son born in this period, and he named his son Legal Tender. According to Vassar College's project on the Depression of 1893, Jacob Coxey proposed many programs that would later win acceptance during the New Deal, but which were considered extremely radical in the 1890s. And, of course, the truth is that the right-wing consider the New Deal, most of the New Deal policies, as radical today, and they're doing their best to eliminate them. Most notably, says the Vassar Project on 1896. Most notably, he advocated the creation of government jobs through which unemployed men could improve the nation's roads and build public works, while also supporting their families. This project, he argued, could be financed through the issue of government bonds. Also quoting the Vassar Project, Coxey's army picked up many allies and sympathizers on its march to Washington, but it also stirred panic among those who feared an insurrection of the unemployed. When the members of the army reached Washington, they were driven from the Capitol lawn. Coxey, who tried to read a prepared statement on the Capitol steps, was jailed for trespassing, though allies later read his speech into the congressional record. Coxey, who founded the newspaper Sound Money, went on to run for U.S. Representative from Ohio in 1894. and he lost to a Republican, and to serve as a delegate in the 1896 Populist Convention. Because of his high profile in that party, many commentators associated populism with Coxeyism. I'm going to read Jacob Coxey's address on behalf of the Industrial Army. The Constitution of the United States guarantees to all citizens the right to peaceably assemble and petition for redress of grievances, and furthermore declares that the right of free speech shall not be abridged. We stand here today to test these guarantees of our Constitution. We choose this place of assemblage because it is the property of the people. Here, rather than at any other spot upon the continent, it is fitting that we should come to mourn over our dead liberties and by our protest arouse the imperiled nation to such action as shall rescue the Constitution and resurrect our liberties. Upon these steps where we stand has been spread a carpet for the royal feet of a foreign princess, the cost of whose lavish entertainment was taken from the public treasury without the consent or the approval of the people. Up these steps, the lobbyists of trusts and corporations have passed unchallenged on their way to committee rooms, access to which we, the representatives of the toiling wealth producers, have been denied. We stand here today on behalf of millions of toilers whose petitions have been buried in committee rooms, whose prayers have been unresponded to, and whose opportunities for honest, remunerative, productive labor have been taken from them by unjust legislation, which protects idlers, speculators, and gamblers. We come to remind Congress, here assembled, of the declaration of a United States Senator, quote, that for a quarter of a century the rich have been growing richer, the poor poorer, and that by the close of the present century the middle class will have disappeared as the struggle for existence becomes fierce and relentless. And that was Jacob Coxey's address of protest on the steps of the Capitol from the Congressional Record, the 53rd Congress, Second Session, May 9th, 1894. All of this seems to have a familiar ring to me. I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something going on here that looks to me like history repeating itself. From the Online Encyclopedia of Washington State History, we have this article. The Northwestern Industrial Army marches to join Coxey's Army on April 25, 1894. The article reads, on April 25, 1894, approximately 650 unemployed men calling themselves the Northwestern Industrial Army march out of Seattle in military formation, heading toward Washington, D.C., to urge Congress to relieve joblessness following the Panic of 1893. The Seattle men plan to join a similar force from Tacoma at Puyallup, and then to travel by train to meet Jacob Schiner Coxey, whose movement for federal relief is called Coxey's Army. In the Panic of 1893, tens of thousands of men were thrown out of work, especially railroad construction crews in the far west. Coxey, a silica sandstone quarry operator from Massillon, Ohio, offered the idea of federally issued bonds for public roads which would put the unemployed to work. He organized a march on Washington, D.C. in March 1894. Numerous groups of men and some women from across the country gathered to join the march. This is an article from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. On April 7, 1894, Seattle's unemployed, quote, all sturdy, active fellows, neatly dressed and with earnest faces, organized themselves as the Northwestern Industrial Army in a vacant Northern Pacific Railroad storage shed at 2nd Avenue South and South Weller Street. They elected Henry Shepard, an unemployed surveyor, as their leader and formed a, quote, regiment of seven companies. While preparing to leave for Washington, D.C., the Army staged several parades through Seattle led by the Rialto Band. One banner carried by the well-drilled marchers read, gold at a premium, humanity at a discount. Citizens and businesses in Seattle provided the men and needy families with food and with some funds. Henry Shepard helped organize a similar group in Tacoma, and that group chose a man called Jumbo Cantwell as their leader. I wonder if he's any relation to Senator Maria Cantwell. If so, I'm sure he's spinning in his grave. Because Cantwell voted for the so-called tort reform, which is really the Working People's Enslavement Act. And of course, no movement like this of workers was going to go without a hitch. Let's see, Riding the Rails is another article here at the Washington State History Online. Shepherd helped organize a similar group in Tacoma, which chose Jumbo Cantwell. We covered that. Across the country, other industrial armies boarded eastbound trains, sometimes with transportation purchased by the cities they were leaving, but more often by stealing rides and often entire trains. The National Guard units were called out in many states to regain control of the railroads and to conduct the armies across state lines. At Puyallup, Henry Shepherd was dismissed for failure to account for funds donated to the army. General Cantwell took over, but he was unable to negotiate free travel from the Northern Pacific. He instructed followers to break into small groups and to board trains away from the stations. 200 specially sworn deputy U.S. Marshals and U.S. Army soldiers patrolled the Northern Pacific to see that the men didn't steal rides. As many as 100 men at a time jumped aboard freights, but crews sidetracked the trains and deputies cleared the cars. For days between Puyallup and Spokane, marshals ejected some industrial army men from trains and arrested others. In Yakima, shooting erupted and one deputy died, shot by another deputy. They get kind of wild when they have an opportunity to use their guns. Marshals arrested 154 men for attempting to steal rides on trains and 18 Yakima citizens for inciting them. All were brought to Seattle by train on May 12, 1894 to stand trial. On May 1, 1894, the main body of Coxey's army arrived in Washington, D.C., and Coxey was jailed for trespassing on the White House lawn. According to the Texas Handbook Online from the University of Texas, Coxey's appeal drew response from as far as the Pacific coast, where contingents of his army were formed. In charge in Los Angeles was Lewis C. Fry. Fry and his men set out on foot from Los Angeles on March 16, 1894, and later boarded a freight train. Several towns gave them food and sped them onwards. On March 21st, the mayor of El Paso wired Governor James Stephen Hogg, asking him to request the War Department to place the garrison at Fort Bliss at the service of the state to repel the expected invasion. Hogg refused, assuring him that Texas was able to enforce its laws and asking him to report any violations. On the evening of March 22nd, Fry and 700 men arrived in El Paso and marched to the city hall, where they were fed and allowed to camp for the night. The next evening, they marched to the railroad yards to await an eastbound train. As the railroads held back trains suited to their purpose, the men camped near the tracks for 2 days. They boarded a Southern Pacific freight on Easter, March 25, 1894. 70 miles east of El Paso, trainmen uncoupled the cars on which the men were riding and left them stranded on the Finley Switch in a barren region. The only inhabitants within miles were a few Mexican families, and no supplies of food or water were within reach. Indignant at this action, Governor Hogg insisted that the railroad company brought the men into the state should carry them on through. Some of the hungry men walked to Sierra Blanca, 20 miles farther east, and a few were able to hop trains. Except for several beeves donated by ranchmen and food sent by El Paso people, Fry's men still had nothing to eat 3 days later. Their plight aroused increasing sympathy. 6 El Paso citizens telegraphed the governor that the infamy of the Southern Pacific in hauling these men from California into the desert, refusing to haul them farther, was without parallel for barbarity. Dallas residents met and endorsed the governor's order that the Southern Pacific transport Fry's men to a place of refuge. The railroad's general manager refused until El Paso people raised money for a special train. So they haul them out into the desert, leave them there to starve. And when the public outcry gets so great that they have to do something about it, they demand money. It sounds like extortion to me. And as you can see, there were industrial armies coming from all over the country to demand some action about the lack of a reasonable financial policy in the United States and reasonable controls on monopoly power and corporate greed. Coxey's protest was described by him as a living petition, and in Montana was referred to as the petition with boots on. The call to arms was heard by responsive audiences in the western states and territories. In California, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, new armies of Coxeyites were raised from among the ranks of the unemployed. Montana's army, recruited largely in Butte because of all the closing of the mines there, was led by General William Hogan, an unemployed teamster from the Moulton Mine. On July 24, 1894, after failing to convince Butte's business community to provide funds for rations and transportation, Hogan's army, comprised of some 500 militant reformers, seized a Northern Pacific freight train and prepared to move on Washington. U.S. Marshal William McDermott attempted to arrest Hogan and his lieutenants, only to be confronted by a large contingent of Butte citizens. Fearing violence at the hands of the mob, who persisted in brandishing arms while referring to the marshal and his deputies as, quote, bloodsuckers, McDermott allowed Hogan's army to depart for points east. Well, that seems to me to be prudent on McDermott's part, since it was pretty obvious that in Butte, Montana, at least, popular opinion was against the established power structure. On reaching Bozeman, the Hoganites received a rousing welcome from the locals and added a few recruits from their ranks, and then rolled on down the line. The citizens of Livingston, whether motivated by solidarity to the cause or by mere boredom, likewise turned out to greet the unemployed heroes as the commandeered train steamed through their town. I get the feeling the writer of this thought that people organizing to protect their rights was a bad idea. On the morning of April 25th, the train bearing Hogan's army pulled into the Northern Pacific Depot in Billings to the cheers of a large, boisterous crowd, including approximately 100 additional recruits. It was at the Billings Depot that McDermott and his deputies finally made a stand and attempted to arrest the Hoganites. Gunfire broke out, and one bystander was killed, and several of Hogan's and McDermott's men were wounded before the marshal withdrew from the battlefield. Hearing of the shooting and alarmed at the potential for additional civilian casualties, Montana Governor John Rickards wired President Grover Cleveland to alert him of the situation. Within hours, U.S. Attorney General Richard Olney authorized the Army stationed at Fort Cobb near Miles City to seize the train and arrest the Hoganites. Unaware of the regular Army's involvement in their affairs, Hogan and his men departed Billings, believing that their way was now cleared to proceed to Washington. On the evening of the 25th, U.S. infantry troops barricaded the Northern Pacific Line just west of the present-day Forsyth, stopped the train, and arrested Hogan and his army. The army then obligingly transported their POWs to the jail in Helena. After the arrests, William Hogan was sentenced to 6 months in jail, while the remainder of the defendants received 30-day sentences. USHistory.com talks about the second Cleveland administration and the labor unrest under his administration. They say Grover Cleveland was a dedicated advocate of law and order and dealt harshly with labor unrest that developed during the Depression of the 1890s. They talk about Coxey's army and the Pullman strike. The Pullman Palace Car Company was the manufacturer of high-quality sleeping and lounge railroad cars. The plant was located in the company town of Pullman, Illinois, near Chicago. Wage cuts were ordered by management as a response to the declining demand for cars during the Depression. However, rents in company-owned housing remained at their previous high levels. Owner George M. Pullman refused offers of arbitration, prompting the American Railway Union to call a strike in May of 1894. The strike occurred immediately after Coxey's march and made some in the country fearful that widespread violence was in the cards. The union, under the leadership of Eugene V. Debs, refused to handle Pullman cars, and the strike rapidly spread across the country. Governor John Peter Altgeld of Illinois refused management requests to summon the militia and sympathized openly with the strikers. Good for him. In July, a federal circuit court issued an injunction ordering the workers back to their jobs based on the power of the government to keep the mails moving and regulate interstate commerce. Debs refused to comply with the injunction and was arrested and later imprisoned. After a mail train was derailed, possibly by union activists, Cleveland followed Attorney General Richard Olney's suggestion to send 2,500 federal soldiers. In the face of such overwhelming force, the strike collapsed within a week. According to the Social Security website, the Great Depression of the 1930s was not the only one in America's history. In fact, it was the third depression of the modern era, following previous economic collapses in the 1840s and again in the 1890s. During the Depression of the 1890s, unemployment was widespread, and many Americans came to the realization that in an industrialized society, the threat to economic security represented by unemployment could strike anyone, even those able and willing to work. Protest movements arose, the most quixotic and noble and notable being that of Coxey's Army. Although his march failed, Coxey's Army was a harbinger of an issue that would rise to prominence as unemployment insurance would become a key element of the future Social Security Act. Ohio would continue to play an important role in the development of unemployment insurance as its state program was one of two looked to as models for the new federal program, the other being a program in operation in Wisconsin. So here we have this guy in 1894, mad as hell about the unemployment situation and how the how Cleveland administration is dealing with the crisis. And out of his thinking and his activism comes the New Deal, unemployment insurance, Social Security, public works programs. All of the things that he advocated in 1893 and 94 became a reality when the next depression came along in 1929. When you look at it, it's no wonder that Eddie Starr sings about Coxey's Army.
You've been listening to Labor News Radio with Glenn Lang. I want to urge everybody to support their local radio station, to support the AINPOS radio project at radioforall.net, support the Indie Media radio project at radio.indiemedia.org, and support KITR in Kettle Falls, Washington. You can do that by sending a check to P.O. Box 456, Kettle Falls, 99141. Make it payable to KITR Radio. Want to thank everybody for listening, and thanks for your support. Labor News Radio is solely responsible for the content of this program. You can email us with your comments and questions at glennwobbly@mailcan.com. That's glennwobbly@mailcan.com. Our website is glennwobbly.mailcan.com.